Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty is off today. On August 21st, a narrow band of America, stretching from Oregon to South Carolina, will be treated at various times and for a few brief moments to the spectacle of a rare, complete solar eclipse. The moon will seemingly move across the face of the sun. The sky will darken and nature and humans will react. The America of 2017 is obviously a very different place than it was 139 years ago. A solar eclipse happened July 29th of 1878, and it was the subject of fierce scrutiny by the scientific community, some of whom traveled a hard journey out west to best observe this celestial event. The eclipse caught the attention, the imagination, and the attention of notables including Thomas Edison, astronomer Mariah Mitchell, and planet hunter James Craig Watson. It was a time when much of the American West was still wild, and as our guest today has written, beneath the romantic patina lay a foundation of ignorance, lawlessness, and brutality. David Barron brings this moment in our history to life in his new book, American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. And David is an admitted eclipse chaser as well, so we have lots of interesting stuff to talk about this hour. David Barron, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary. I'm thrilled to be here.
And our comment number is 267-405-2006. So if you'd like to give us a call or send us a text, that is the number to work with. So, David Barron, before we head back to the late 19th century America, let's get a sense of the effect a solar eclipse can have on humans. You write in your book that you discovered your purpose on a beach outside a Hyatt Regency in Aruba. This was 1998. A total solar eclipse was going to happen. And if you could start us off by reading a passage from your book.
Yes. So this is February 26, 1998. So here goes. As a science journalist, I thought I knew what to expect. For 174 seconds, the blue sky would blacken, stars would appear, and the sun would manifest its ethereal outer atmosphere, the solar corona. What I had not anticipated was my own intense reaction to the display. For three glorious minutes, I felt transported to another planet, indeed, to a higher plane of reality, as my consciousness departed the Earth and I gaped at an alien sky. Above me, in the dim vault of the heavens, shone an incomprehensible object. It looked like an enormous wreath woven from silvery thread, and it hung suspended in the immensity of space, shimmering. As I stood transfixed by this vision, I felt something I had never experienced before, a visceral connection to the universe, and I became an umbraphile, an eclipse chaser, one who has since obsessively stalked the moon's shadow across Europe, Asia, Australia, for yet a few more fleeting moments of lunar nirvana.
Wow. So is this a common response among people you know who've been fortunate enough to view a complete solar eclipse?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, a total eclipse for many people is a life-changing experience. It's really, again, I went there thinking this was going to be something I'd be observing kind of from a scientific point of view, but it really was spiritual. Now, I'm not a traditionally religious person, but for me, it was spiritual. It just tapped into something very, very deep in the back of my brain, and a lot of people have that reaction. It's just overwhelming.
And so, David Barron, you wanted to know how others responded. So eventually you ended up at the Library of Congress. What did you find there?
Well, so 1998, I saw my first total solar eclipse and was just dumbfounded and decided I wanted to keep chasing eclipses. I also decided in 1998, as a science writer, that I was going to write a book about eclipse chasing. But I knew that the time to come out with the book would be this summer, because the summer of 2017, this is when Americans will care about eclipses. So I put the project on hold, and about 6 years ago, I started looking around for a good story. It very quickly became clear to me that the best eclipse stories are from the 19th century, a time when total solar eclipses were really important to astronomy. So I started looking around and I discovered, we'll talk a lot more about this, but the eclipse of 1878, which has so many interesting characters and so many interesting stories, and many of those astronomers have left their papers to archives. And since a number of them worked for the U.S. government at the U.S. Naval Observatory or were just famous Americans, their papers are at the Library of Congress. And so a lot of the documents from the folks who witnessed the 1878 eclipse are in the manuscript collection there.
So outside the scientific community, as you write in your book, you know, predictions of the world's imminent demise were not uncommon in 19th century America, judgment day predictions. And, you know, some knew, of course, what they were witnessing in a solar eclipse, but many did not at that time in our nation's history, some to tragic effect. I mean, you tell the story of Ephraim Miller.
Yeah, he lived in Texas. So Texas, the reaction in Texas to the eclipse of 1878 was quite different from the reaction elsewhere. So the eclipse of 1878 was visible as a total eclipse along a path that went from Montana territory down to Texas, right along the American frontier. And in Colorado and Wyoming, from all my research, people knew the eclipse was coming. They were excited about it. They didn't think of it as something supernatural. But it was a fascinating thing to watch. A lot of people in Texas just were not aware it was coming. And you can imagine being out in your cotton field in the middle of a hot July afternoon, and suddenly it goes dark. And you look up in the sky, and the sun is gone. And where the sun was, you now see this glorious kind of golden crown shimmering out there in space. Well, a lot of these folks were deeply religious, and they were absolutely convinced that this was Christ returning. And the story of Ephraim Miller is tragic.
Yes.
He was sure it was Judgment Day. He wanted to avoid the apocalypse and get to the other side as quickly as possible, and he wanted to bring his young son with him. So he took a hatchet, killed his son, and then he took his own life with a razor.
Yeah. Solar eclipses have prompted extraordinary human reactions throughout time. Tell us a bit about the Medes and the Lydians.
So the Medes and the Lydians, this is believed to be 585 BC in Asia Minor. These two warring powers, the Medes and the Lydians, and they had been fighting for 6 years. This is according to Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, and he says that, but in the middle of... Again, after fighting for 6 years, it suddenly went dark in the middle of the day. And that convinced them that clearly the gods were not happy, and they stopped fighting because of the total eclipse. And this eclipse, one of the wonderful things about total eclipses, or eclipses in general, is they are completely predictable by our modern science. So scientists have been able to go back and ask, on what date was there a total eclipse in this part of Asia Minor? And so that's how they've come up with it. I forget the specific date, but the year is 585 BC, when indeed a total eclipse passed that area.
So back to the 19th century, how was the solar eclipse of 1878 predictable to the scientific community, which really had it pinpointed fairly accurately?
Yeah, they were off by maybe a mile on either side of exactly the path where the moon's shadow would go. Well, so I'll go back even further. Eclipse prediction in general goes back to ancient times. Even the ancient Chinese, the Mayans, the Babylonians figured out that eclipses come in patterns. In fact, they repeat, a given eclipse will repeat after 18 years and 10 days on another part of the planet. But so a lunar eclipse today, 18 years, 10 and one-third days later, it'll happen again. So they figured that out. But predicting the path of the total eclipse, that takes more complicated math. You know that some solar eclipse will occur on a particular date, but where will it be total? That's difficult. And it wasn't until really the 18th century that scientists figured out the orbits and were able to calculate quite well. By the 19th century, they were very good at it. Now, mind you, they didn't have electronic computers. All this math was done by hand. But quite accurate eclipse maps were out for the 1878 eclipse.
All right, so in 1878, prior to the eclipse, you've got scientific expeditions forming to head out west. So I'd like to get into some of the people who were among those who went out west. Thomas Alva Edison, of course, a prominent figure in your book. He was only 29 years old at the time of the centennial, actually probably a couple of years older.
31, for the eclipse, right?
And, you know, a local angle here, he was from Menlo Park, New Jersey?
Right.
Okay, that's in Middlesex County, New Jersey, which likely looked very different then. And you go a little bit into Thomas Edison's life at the time. I'd like to take just a moment to, A, paint that picture, and B, find out, you know, where did you find this information out about Thomas Edison?
I just adore Thomas Edison. I had so much fun spending the last 6 years living with him, writing this book. I mean, I was reading his lab notebooks and letters and interviews with him. So Thomas Edison, at the time of the 1878 eclipse, he had just become a global celebrity. So
for his inventions, he didn't consider himself to be a scientist.
Well, right? See, this is a forgotten part of Edison's life, because most books about Edison are written about kind of the older Edison, and in later years, he was quite adamant that he was not a scientist. He was an inventor. In fact, he would talk disparagingly a bit about the academic scientists, that they were so busy in their ivory towers, they really didn't know how the world worked. He was out there getting his hands dirty.
Yeah.
But the young Thomas Edison, at 31 years of age, really respected academic scientists and kind of wanted to be one. He certainly wanted their respect. And yes, he was an inventor, but he was really interested in astronomy. And so in 1878, he had this idea for – he came up with an invention that he brought out to Wyoming to study the eclipsed sun. But anyway, just to answer your question about this information, I mean, a lot of information about Edison has been collected at Rutgers by the Edison Papers Project, mm-hmm. and that's wonderful. But in the course of writing this book, I found a lot of stuff that has not been published since 1878 about yeah. Edison. There were so many newspaper articles in these tiny little papers. As Edison traveled west, he was such a celebrity, the local paper would do an interview with him. And so there are these – I've uncovered these conversations with Edison from 1878 that, again, I don't think have seen the light of day since 1878.
Yeah. Well, and back to the invention for a moment. Is it the tazimeter?
The tazimeter.
Tazimeter. Right. Thank you. And what did this do? He brought it out to the West with him, among one of these scientific expeditions. What was he trying to determine with this instrument?
Right. So the tazimeter, which of course no one's ever heard of, but at the time was thought it was going to be bigger than the phonograph. Well, that didn't pan out. The tazimeter was an extremely sensitive heat detector. It was – today we'd call it an infrared detector, but it was like a really sensitive electric thermometer. You could point it at an object and it would pick up heat radiation coming off. And Edison claimed it could measure differences in temperature as small as 1/1000th of a degree Fahrenheit. And it was designed for astronomy. The main reason he devised it and what he used it for during the eclipse was to study the solar corona. Today we know it is the sun's outer atmosphere, and you can only see it with the naked eye during a total solar eclipse. Back then, it wasn't clear what it was. And so one of the questions was, well, we see light coming off of the corona, whatever it is. Does it also give off heat? And so Edison devised the tazimeter and brought it with him. So during those 3 minutes, he would point it at the corona and try to measure its heat.
All right. After the break, we're going to talk about another person who headed out west with an expedition. That is astronomer Mariah Mitchell. Edison's expedition was funded by the government. Hers was not. We'll talk about all that with author David Barron, author of American Eclipse. And he is here with us for the entire hour of Radio Time. So stay with us. More just ahead. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Science writer David Barron tells the story of the solar eclipse of 1878 and the scientists who chased it across the country in his new book, American Eclipse, The Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. And again, our comment line number is 267-405-2006 if you'd like to send us a comment or a text. And going into the break, we were talking about some of these scientific expeditions and who were among the people heading out west. Mariah Mitchell was an astronomer who David came along at a time when almost all professional scientists were male. And she was a computer. Now, a while back on one of the shows we did here on Radio Times, we talked about the female computers of the time. Give us a refresher. What did the computer do?
Right. So back then, the word computer described a human profession, the way a printer was. You know, we think of a printer as a computer printer. A printer was a person. A computer was a person. A computer was someone who was hired to do really complicated calculations. And Mariah Mitchell, among her jobs, was she computed the orbit of Venus. She was actually hired by the U.S. Navy, which put out something called the Nautical Almanac, which was basically a table of where you would find the various planets on any given day and other things in the sky during a given year, and it was an aid for navigation. And so Mariah Mitchell, by hand, using these complicated formulas, calculated where Venus was on any given day for the almanac.
So Mariah Mitchell was a professor at Vassar.
Right.
But she did not get equal treatment there. And if you could, I'd like you to grab your book and head to page 38. There's a paragraph that's really interesting. If you could read that for us to give us some insight.
Despite teaching at a women's college, Mitchell received less than half the salary paid to the school's male professors, an injustice she fought with some success. And while astronomers at other universities were offered generous faculty housing, Mitchell occupied the sparest of accommodations. For her first decade at Vassar, she slept on a sofa in the corner of a box-like space that alternately served as parlor and lecture room. When the college finally provided her with a separate apartment for sleeping, it had previously been the observatory's coal storeroom, one of her students marked the occasion in tongue-in-cheek verse. "Beautiful Venus, pride of the morning, tell it to all little stars who have fled, that in a sweet chamber that needs no adorning, Miss Mitchell sleeps in a bed."
And that Venus reference is what you were talking
about.
Yeah,
right. Where she was connected to the planet Venus, yeah.
Also, you know, a few months before the eclipse of 1878, I believe the fledgling National Academy of Sciences was meeting. No Mariah Mitchell there, no women allowed. But ironically, her picture was on the wall.
Well, so the National Academy of Sciences meetings back then were held at the Smithsonian Institution because the National Academy didn't have its own offices. And the head of the Smithsonian, Joseph Henry, a very prominent physicist, he was a real fan of Mariah Mitchell's, and he kind of mentored her. And I never did find out who put her picture on the wall, but I'm quite sure it was Joseph Henry.
Mm. We're going to get to more of Mariah Mitchell in just a moment, but continuing with our expedition teams, one of the big debates, David, of the late 19th century was whether there was an unseen planet lurking close to the sun. And that planet's name, well, the ostensible planet, it was named what, Vulcan?
Vulcan, right. So before it ever showed up on Star Trek, I mean, that's where they got the idea. Vulcan, back in the mid-1800s, was a hypothetical planet. Many astronomers were convinced that it existed, and so their belief was it orbited the sun between Mercury and the sun. Mercury was thought not to be the closest planet to the sun. And the reason is Mercury's orbit didn't quite make sense. Calculating what Mercury's orbit should be based on Newtonian physics, it was just acting bizarrely. And so the theory was, the explanation was, that there must be another planet closer to the sun than Mercury that's kind of tugging it along. And so astronomers gave it a name, Vulcan. But no one had ever reliably seen it. Now, that's not a great surprise because it's so close to the sun, it would never be in the sky at night, mm-hmm. and you can't see it in the daytime because it's going to be lost in the sun's glare. About the only time you might catch a glimpse of Vulcan would be during those brief few minutes during a total eclipse when the moon covers the sun entirely and you can see what's around the sun. So looking for Vulcan was one of the big things that scientists were doing in the West during the eclipse of 1878.
And enter, is it James Craig?
James Craig Watson.
Watson,
yeah.
Okay, so that was his primary reason heading out there, was to find Vulcan and make his name.
Oh, yeah.
As the man who finally was located. Yeah.
James Craig Watson, well, if anyone was going to find Vulcan, it was going to be James Craig Watson. He was an astronomer at the University of Michigan, the head of the observatory there, and he was famous in that era as a planet hunter. Now, back then, asteroids were considered planets. They were considered minor planets, but they were given names just like the major planets, and finding them was a very big deal. And James Craig Watson had found more asteroids than just about anyone else on Earth, and he was convinced that Vulcan existed. And my goodness, because Vulcan would be a major planet, right? Not just a little piece of rock. This was a large planet, large-ish. And he was convinced it existed. He went to look for it, And I don't want to give the whole story away, but he thought he found it.
Well, yeah, you'll have to turn the pages to find that. It's a really well-written, exciting little chase inside the book. So all right, so we know the solar eclipse is happening July 29th of 1878, and Congress has finally approved money to fund scientific expeditions to the West. The U.S. Naval Observatory, I believe, is seeking volunteers. Mm-hmm. Notably absent from the list of those invited is Mariah Mitchell.
Correct. Yeah. So,
how did she react?
Well, so she was going to have none of it. Mariah Mitchell, the professor of astronomy at Vassar College, again esteemed as a computer, but more than that, she became famous in 1847 for discovering a comet before anyone else on Earth, and she received a gold medal from the King of Denmark. She was the most prominent female scientist in America in that age. I mean, she was a household name. But when the U.S. Naval Observatory was putting out a call for scientist volunteers to go west for the eclipse of 1878, invitations were sent to Princeton and Harvard and the University of Michigan and Johns Hopkins and other schools, but no invitation was sent to Vassar. And Mariah Mitchell even asked whether, maybe the Naval Observatory could help her out by, inquiring with the railroads if they would give her a cut on railroad fares, because they were doing that for the male scientists. The Naval Observatory asked the railroads to give half-price fares. She got no help whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so she just decided she's not going out on a government expedition. No one's helping her. But she put together on her own an all-female eclipse expedition to the Wild West in 1878.
And here's a great historical tidbit that one of a number that you include in the book. She asks the daughter of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the suffragist leader, and what do Harriet Stanton's parents tell Harriet about going on this
trip? Well, they told her she couldn't go because it was too expensive. Harriet Stanton, who then became Harriet Stanton Blatch when she was married later on, and she herself was a prominent women's rights advocate, in her memoirs, she says that missing the eclipse of 1878 was the greatest disappointment of her life. Because later on, I think it was 1925, she finally saw a total solar eclipse and was so taken by the experience, she just was so regretted that she never got to see the one in 1878.
Hmm. Let's take just a quick aside here, David Barrett. Just want to point out that the more things change, of course, the more they seem to stay the same. In the political world, in the spring and summer of 1878, the nation's relitigating the contested presidential election with a congressional investigation into voter fraud. So could you digress for just a moment and get into that for us?
Yeah, well, the 1876 election was a big deal. When it was Samuel Tilden versus Rutherford B. Hayes. And so Tilden, if I think I have this right, that Tilden won the popular vote. Hayes did not, but he ended up getting the electoral vote, although, I mean, it was a very complicated, long, contested election, right. And many people believe that really Tilden won. But in the end, it was settled that Hayes won. But yeah, this was a deeply divided time politically. Yeah.
And Democrats apparently mocked President Hayes as his fraudulency.
Right.
Interesting. All right. So back to our expedition and back to Thomas Edison. So at this time, right, as he's about to head out on this expedition, he is working furiously. He is burning out, right? And the expedition, I guess, is just what the doctor ordered. And enter Henry Draper, again, another name from a show that we did, on the female computers. What happens then?
Well, so Thomas Edison, he was not originally thinking he would go west for the eclipse, but he did invent, as we mentioned earlier, the tizimeter. It was another astronomer who had encouraged him to build the tizimeter, and several astronomers were asking Edison if they might have a tizimeter to take out west for the eclipse. Edison is exhausted, kind of needs a break from the lab. And so Henry Draper, who was a professor at NYU, was putting together a private eclipse expedition. And Draper invited George Barker. George Barker was a physicist at the University of Pennsylvania. And Barker and Edison were kind of chums. And Barker then extended an invitation to Edison. So it was a small band. And then the other scientist to go on that expedition was Henry Morton, who was the president of the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken.
So the West, of course, of the 19th century, late 19th century, was truly in parts the wild, wild
West.
Yeah. I was talking to our engineer, Adam Staniszewski, off mic here, and he said that in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, you know, for the eclipse this year, I guess it's in the path, hotels are already sold out.
Let me just say, I booked my hotel in Jackson, Wyoming 3 years ago. Seriously.
So, but back in 1878, Wyoming is still a territory, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and not necessarily a destination that the 19th century traveler would want to linger in. And again, I guess at the time, travelers had to go through what was then still known as Indian Territory, as you write about all this in your book. Let's get a sense of what train travel was like back then, heading out west. Far cry from Amtrak. Again, you've written about this. We have a passage on page 106. And if you could kind of get into that for us a little bit.
Right. So I think this passage is that you've got me reading is the beginning of the trip. Mm-hmm. There were folks leaving from all across the east to head west.
Yeah.
So this is what one person wrote. The ride to Harrisburg was excessively disagreeable, being hot, dusty, and smoky, a student from Johns Hopkins complained at the start of his journey to Colorado. Another young astronomer found Pittsburgh simply dreadful. I've never seen any description of it that I can now pronounce overdrawn. Dark, dusty, down in a gully, everything full of smoke and coal black, and the air of the entire place scandalously vile with coal gas, which almost suffocated me. But soon the landscape opened up. Fields and fields of corn growing luxuriantly, comprising hundreds of acres, extending nearly as far as the eye can reach. The westbound scientists joined an eclectic mix of characters, a patchwork of tourists, immigrants, gold seekers, cowboys, politicians, and businessmen. The astronomy student from Johns Hopkins, crossing Kansas, eyed the passengers in his car warily. There is a pretty rough crowd on board, one fellow opposite with a bag from which he periodically pulls a huge whiskey bottle and takes a drink, and another, evidently a drover, with huge cowhide boots covered with mud, which he rests on the back of the seat before him. Texas Jack, who's a character who I've mentioned earlier in the book, the irrepressible eastern showman and handsome western scout, was on another train, heading to Wyoming to guide a hunt for a pair of New Yorkers, one a banana importer. A witness on board noted that Jack endeavored to get up a flirtation with a very pretty Swedish maiden, but enjoyed little luck as the girl spoke no English.
Well, now, travel on a train for women was also not supposed to be good for them physically. It was discouraged, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, there was
What was the theory there, David?
Well, back then, women were thought to be incredibly fragile. And so, yeah, there was a theory that too much jostling was not good for the reproductive organs and was not good for a woman's health.
Mm. Well, perhaps more critically to a person's health, a train ride west could also involve bandits, and the train lines themselves sabotaged each other. Could you tell us about what these people heading out to view the eclipse were risking?
Oh, yeah. Well, so, I mean, you know, train robbery was a real issue out west. And, in fact, the very train that Edison was on in Wyoming just a few weeks beforehand had been robbed. The passengers were robbed at gunpoint. And a few weeks afterwards, some folks tried to blow up the tracks to derail the train, and then they were going to rob it. So this was a real risk. And then, rail travel, you basically had to go from one railroad company to another, and you transition. And sometimes the railroads just really weren't getting along. And this is something that Mariah Mitchell encountered along her way, where one railroad that she was transferring from to another, the two were in what is called a railroad war. And her bags ended up hostages of that war. She had trouble getting them transferred from one railroad to the other.
Yeah, and I love the turn of phrase in the book. You write, "The moon, an ever-shrinking crescent in the dawn sky, orbited the Earth at more than 2,000 miles per hour as it inexorably headed toward its rendezvous with the sun. Mitchell's bags, however, sat immobile 120 miles to the south in Pueblo, where they had become prisoners of the railroad war." So not easy, but they fought through and they did eventually get there. So Thomas Edison makes it to Rawlins, Wyoming. Describe the town of Rawlins.
Rawlins, Wyoming, well, and it's still there today. It is and was a railroad town. It was constructed for, it was founded for the construction of the Union Pacific Railroad, the Transcontinental Railroad. And it basically was a place where trains went into the shop if they needed to be repaired. And but it was a bleak place. I mean, no shrubbery, no greenery. It's basically in a high desert. And, you know, saloons and brothels and gunfights, all that sort of stuff.
Who is Big Nose George?
What
happened to him?
Oh, geez, poor Big Nose George. Yeah, so I mentioned that a few weeks after Edison went through the area, some folks tried to blow up tracks.
Yeah.
Big Nose George was part of Big Nose George Parrott was the one of the folks who was of that band. They were stopped before they blew up the tracks. But then a sheriff's deputy went after them and some other folks. And in the process, the bandits killed the sheriff's deputy and someone who was with them. Eventually, Big Nose George was arrested. He was taken into the Rawlins jail, and he tried to escape. And, well, but was caught. And in the end, the people of Rawlins would have none of it, and they lynched him. Yeah. It's just the most brutal, brutal lynching. They hung him from a telegraph pole, and this is what I write in the book is all from original documents. Mm, I mean, it's from the paper the next day. It's from what was written at the coroner's inquest about what happened. And it's and just to end the story of Big Nose George, after he was lynched and an autopsy was performed on him, the local doctor decided that they would keep his body for doing experimentation. And while they were at it, they took some souvenirs. So his skull cap was given to a young girl who was assisting with the autopsy. She used it as an ashtray. And the skin from his chest was tanned and turned into a pair of shoes.
Oh, dear. Dear heavens.
Yeah.
Okay, we're up against a break. But as you said, a foundation of ignorance, lawlessness, and brutality that's beneath the romantic patina of the American West at the time. Okay, well, we're going to get a little closer to the eclipse after the break here. David Barron is an author who's written American Eclipse. More just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty is off today, and our guest this hour is David Barron. He is a journalist, author, and broadcaster who spent his 30-year career largely in public radio. He is also the author of American Eclipse, The Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. And we're talking about the eclipse of 1878. We were talking about the Wild West going into the break. Just briefly, David, some of the expedition were also headed to Denver because the eclipse is going to be seen there too. It was a modern city for its time. So not all of the West was as wild as, you know, Wyoming was, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. I mean, no, Denver definitely thought of itself as sophisticated. I mean, they had horse-drawn trolleys and municipal water and gas piped underground and, an opera house. So Denver was certainly surrounded by quite a wild place, but it at least aspired to sophistication.
So after all the work that was done to prepare the expeditions to travel out west, to set up camp, and they had to practice too, right? They're going to practice everything because this all happens how quickly?
Less than 3 minutes. So here they've been preparing for years, really putting together their expeditions for months, traveling for days or weeks, and it all comes down to 3 minutes. So they need to make the most of every second. And they had mapped out, you know, what am I going to do for the first 15 seconds and then the next 10 seconds. And so they would practice and practice and practice. So when the eclipse occurred, hopefully they would make use of every available second.
And still, one uncontrollable factor could just wreck the whole thing, which was
the weather, right? And that's still true today, obviously.
It's still true today. I mean, obviously it is. We can't control the weather.
So, you know, you can... You know exactly when the moon's shadow is going to pass. We can predict that years, decades, centuries in advance. But you're going to miss the show if a single cloud is right in the way at the wrong time.
So if it's overcast, there's still a darkening,
dark,
but it's not.
But you're not going to see the most spectacular thing, which is to actually look at the eclipsed sun and see the solar corona, this beautiful aura around the eclipse sun. Mm.
So going along for the 1878 eclipse was a man who was a meteorologist? Would we call Cleveland Abbey? Okay, so he was also an astronomer. Where was the art of weather forecasting in the late 19th century?
It was rapidly developing. So Cleveland Abbey, who today is often referred to as the father of the National Weather Service, he really pioneered weather forecasting at first when he was living in Cincinnati, and then he was hired by the U.S. government to be its first meteorologist when the Weather Service was founded at the time as part of the U.S. Army. But anyway, Cleveland Abbey was originally an astronomer, and he had seen a total solar eclipse in 1869 in Dakota Territory and was dazzled by it. And he wanted to go see the 1878 eclipse, so he convinced his boss to let him go to Colorado and to climb Pike's Peak, 14,000 feet high.
Mm. And unfortunately for poor Cleveland Abbey, he ended up watching it flat on his back.
Oh, the story of Cleveland Abbey, what he did for the eclipse of 1878. I mean, again, he was up on top of Pike's Peak, battling snowstorms in July and severe altitude sickness. I mean, his life was in danger. And after all this time and all this preparation and all this travel, the night before the eclipse, I mean, he's an invalid on top of Pike's Peak, and he's carried down the mountain.
What did they know about altitude sickness at the time?
Not that much. They certainly didn't know. They knew it existed, and they knew it could be deadly. But exactly what was going on, which was that Abbey's brain, in essence, was swelling and pressing against the inside of his skull. But they knew he was in bad shape. And so Cleveland Abbey, after all this time wanting to see the eclipse from the top of Pike's Peak, was thrown on a litter and carried down the mountain the night before.
Let's talk about the actual viewing of a solar eclipse. Is it safe to watch any part of it with the naked eye?
All right, so a few basics, right? So it is never safe to look at the surface of the sun with the naked eye, even when the moon is covering most of the sun. So here in Philadelphia on August 21st, you will get an 80% partial eclipse. So it will never be safe to look at with the naked eye. You can look at it safely with a pair of inexpensive eclipse glasses, which you can easily find online.
What do they do?
They have extremely dark lenses. You'll look through them and you'll think, well, these don't work. I can't see anything. The only thing, if you stare at a light bulb, you won't see anything. But if you stare at the sun, you'll see the sun as just this bright circle. So in Philadelphia and in most of North America, it will never be safe on August 21st to look at the sun with the naked eye. However, if you are in what's called the path of totality, 70 miles wide, that goes from Oregon to South Carolina, and that's where the eclipse will be total. That's where the moon's shadow will fall across the United States. During the up to 2 minutes 40 seconds of the total eclipse, it is safe to look with the naked eye. In fact, you need to look at it with the naked eye to really appreciate it. You won't see anything through the eclipse glass.
Well, how do you know when to look up?
Well, so if you're watching up, a total eclipse begins as a partial eclipse. It'll take about an hour and a half for the moon to progress from just touching the sun to covering it completely.
And so wear your special glasses.
So you're wearing your special glasses, and you're seeing how the sun becomes a crescent, and then the crescent shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And in those final moments, you're looking through your eclipse glasses, and the crescent disappears. And in the meantime, the landscape around you will go dark. It won't go dark like midnight, but sort of like a twilight. And at that point, when you can't see anything through the eclipse glasses, you can take them off. And what you'll see is not a crescent, but you'll see this beautiful, glowing, like wreath in the sky, and that's the solar corona.
So how does nature react?
Nature thinks that it's a weird and unexpected dusk. So I would say within about 10 minutes of the total eclipse, birds start getting confused. They'll start flying around like it's dusk. You might see fireflies or bats come out. Farm animals will react. Chickens will go home to roost, and cows might turn home, that sort of thing.
So back in 1878, what did they know about viewing the solar eclipse and safety, and what might they have used?
Yeah, well, so don't do what they did.
Okay.
They did have eclipse glasses, but they were not nearly so sophisticated. Their eclipse glasses were either really dark pieces of stained glass or people would take a piece of clear glass and smoke it over a flame to make it really dark. And that's how they viewed it. I have no reports of people going blind, but they may in fact have damaged their vision in some subtle ways. And by today's standards, that's not considered safe. Don't use sunglasses. You could only want to use, the very darkest welding glasses are okay, but only the darkest ones. Really what you should do is, they cost $2, get yourself a pair of certifiably safe eclipse glasses.
And we have a question here. What time does the partial solar eclipse hit Philadelphia on August 21st? Do you know offhand?
Yeah, it's a little after 1 in the afternoon. I know that it reaches its maximum at 2:44 in the afternoon, and that's when it'll be about 80%. The sun will be about 80% covered by the moon.
So back to the expedition. Simon Newcomb is another. I don't think we explained who he was. Who was Simon?
Simon Newcomb
was a polymath, right?
Oh, he was an astronomer. He was a professor. He was an economist. He was a writer. He was a very prominent intellectual in America at that time. But his paying job was as an astronomer. In fact, by 1878, he was the head of the Navy's Nautical Almanac Office, which published the Nautical Almanac, which helped navigators, and that's what Mariah Mitchell used to work for as a computer. But he was just a very respected intellectual at the time.
And he wants to view the outer corona during mm-hmm. the eclipse of 1878, and he rigs a system to hide the bright inner corona of the sun. What does he do, and then what does he find?
Well, so, people were just looking for all sorts of different ways to study the corona, which it was just a great mystery at that time. No one knew what it was. So they were trying to see, how far does it extend? Is it symmetrical? What's its shape? And because it changes from eclipse to eclipse as well. So he had this idea, since the corona goes from very bright near the sun to very dim farther out, and it's very hard for the eye to pick up that entire range of brightness. He wanted to see how far it extended, so he kind of blocked the whole inner corona, and he, in essence, eclipsed the eclipsed sun. So he, in Wyoming, set up a big round disc of wood on top of a telegraph pole and figured out where he would stand at the time of the eclipse so that that round piece of wood would cover the sun and moon and beyond, and then he could look at the outer portion of the corona. And I actually have in my book, I've got a lot of illustrations in the book, and I include an illustration that he had showing just how far these tendrils, these streamers of the corona extended.
I don't know if you have this information at your fingertips, but does modern science know how far these tendrils extend?
Well, in essence, they extend all the way to the Earth. The thing is, the corona becomes what's called the solar wind. So the corona is made up of charged particles, extraordinarily hot, more than 1,000,000 degrees, that are being accelerated into space, and it becomes what is called the solar wind. And as it passes by the Earth, it's what causes the northern lights. So there's not really a clear distinction between the corona and the solar wind. But however far you might see it, it depends on how sensitive your detector is.
Speaking of, not the solar wind, but just the wind we experience here on Earth, you say that a solar eclipse can change not only the sense of daytime, but it can affect the wind as well?
Right, because, all of a sudden, normally during the daytime, you've got all this solar radiation coming in. It's causing clouds to form and heating up the lower levels of the atmosphere. Suddenly, that's gone, and so it changes. It can change the weather in strange ways. Sometimes, if the day is still, it'll become windy. If it's windy, it'll become still. And in Wyoming, on eclipse day, it had been extremely windy, and at the time of the eclipse, suddenly it became still, which was very good news for Thomas Edison because he was having great problems because of the wind.
So back to the Vassar Party and Mariah Mitchell. You write that viewing the eclipse is arguably less important than being viewed. How so?
Well, so Mariah Mitchell puts together this all-female eclipse party. There were six in all, six women. And they did have science they were intending to do, just like all the other male scientists. They were looking for the planet Vulcan. They were sketching the corona. But Mariah Mitchell knew just how remarkable what she had done putting this expedition together was. And this was a time when there were not many women in science, and in fact, a lot of the public thought that women couldn't do science, women shouldn't do science, that higher education isn't good for a woman's health. And so...
what was the reasoning there?
So, in 1873, a Harvard doctor named Edward H. Clarke came out with a sensational best-selling book that claimed that higher education was literally bad for a woman's health. And his argument was, and he had anecdotes that he claimed back this ridiculous theory up, that if a maturing girl used her brain too much, that would sap energy that was supposed to go to her maturing reproductive organs. And therefore, higher education could turn young women into these masculine, sterile invalids. I mean, that is literally what he claimed. And so here in 1878, Mariah Mitchell, with that as a backdrop, had to show that here is this group of smart, educated, healthy women, feminine as well, because Edward Clarke was saying that that education masculinizes women, which was thought, of course, to be a terrible thing. And so here Mariah Mitchell, there's this wonderful photograph I've got in my book, American Eclipse, where of the Vassar College Eclipse Party, these women in Victorian dresses out on the plains of Colorado with their telescopes.
So did Mariah Mitchell's expedition then have a noticeable effect on the availability of higher education for women?
I mean, she opened the door a crack. So I was just really struck by the newspaper reports about the expedition and just really praising her and I mean, saying what an inspiration she was to young women and to men as well. But obviously, it's not like after the expedition in 1878, suddenly the doors of science were flung open to women. It was the beginning of a very long, hard slog to make science more open to women. And you mentioned Davis O'Bell in her book, The Glass Universe. And that really, it's a wonderful book. It's about kind of the next generation of women and what these women that she writes about at Harvard around the turn of the century. One of them, in fact, was a student of Mariah Mitchell's, but also Mariah Mitchell really paved the way for what was done at Harvard later.
Well, let's fast forward to August 21st of 2017. Where will you be, David Barron?
I will be in Jackson, Wyoming, up in the Tetons. It's right in the path of the total eclipse. And
that's
again,
right. You booked your hotel 3 years
ago. I did. And again, I need to stress that Philadelphia will see an 80% partial eclipse. That's interesting. That's really good as a partial eclipse goes.
Does that darken things significantly?
No. But it's absolutely nothing compared with a total eclipse. It's a fundamentally different experience. And I would encourage as many people as possible to not accept an 80% eclipse as good enough. You must get to the path of totality.
And again, that's 70 miles wide, stretching
right
from Oregon to
South Carolina.
And I'm sure a lot of places are booked up by people who have been
aware of this.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll need to rent an RV. You'll need to impose on a friend. But, I mean, if you go – there's a lot of stuff online. But if you go to my website, which is American-Eclipse.com, I've got a page devoted to the August eclipse and links to sites that like NASA and so forth that have a lot of information where you can find maps and see precisely how long the total eclipse will last. But I would encourage you, it's a Monday, but take the kids out of school if they're in school. Take off work. Go. It's like traveling to another planet. It's the most marvelous, marvelous experience.
Well, have a wonderful time.
Thank you.
This has been fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
David Barron is author of American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadow of the Moon and Win the Glory of the World. And as always, we invite you to visit our Facebook page, take a listen to our podcasts. They're easy to access at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nouri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.